Namaste. We return to Sri Aurobindo's essays on the Gita. And we enter chapter 4, the core of the teaching, as it was retitled when it came out in book form, the first series, 1923. But in the Arya, we saw it first on the 15th of November in 1916. And we remember the context. Sri Aurobindo has come to the Gita looking for what he can say to us in the here and now, and looking at the primary elements. Who is the teacher? Who represents the human aspiration? What is the message fundamentally? And that we turn to now. So let's read some. We know. Will I be able to speak tonight? Stay tuned. We know the divine teacher. We see the human disciple. It remains to form a clear conception of the doctrine. A clear conception fastening upon the essential idea, the central heart of the teaching, is especially necessary here, because the Gita, with its rich and many-sided thought, its synthetical grasp of different aspects of the spiritual life, and the fluent winding motion of its argument, lends itself, even more than other scriptures, to one-sided misrepresentations born of a partisan intellectuality. So this is a multifaceted teaching, multidimensional, and we can seize upon any single facet and stand with some justice and say, this is true of the Gita, but it's not wholly true. A person won't be entirely wrong, but they will only be partly right. This word partisan, from the Latin partis, which means part, that tells you the whole of it. A partisan, as a noun, is a person who is an unreasoning adherent, who takes a position ignoring the rest. The part should not dominate the whole. The part is indispensable, but cannot, when it is unconscious of the rest, stand for the rest. The unconscious or half-conscious resting of fact and word and idea to suit a preconceived notion or the doctrine or principle of one's preference is recognized by Indian logicians as one of the most fruitful sources of fallacy. And it is perhaps the one which it is most difficult for even the most conscientious thinker to avoid. For the human reason is incapable of always playing the detective upon itself in this respect. It is its very nature to seize upon some partial conclusion, idea, principle, become its partisan, and make it the key to all truth. And it has an infinite faculty of doubling upon itself so as to avoid detecting in its operations this necessary and cherished weakness. The Gita lends itself easily to this kind of error because it is easy, by throwing particular emphasis on one of its aspects, or even on some salient and emphatic text, and putting all the rest of the 18 chapters into the background, or making them a subordinate and auxiliary teaching to turn it into a partisan of our own doctrine or dogma. To go from the part to the whole, to integrate, is to achieve wholeness. Thus, there are those who make the Gita teach not works at all, but a discipline of preparation for renouncing life and works. Advaita Vedanta. The indifferent performance of prescribed actions or of whatever task may lie ready to the hands becomes the means, the discipline. The final renunciation of life and works is the sole real object. It is quite easy to justify this view by citations from the book and by a certain arrangement of stress and following out its argument, especially if we shut our eyes to the peculiar way in which it uses such a word as sannyasa, renunciation. But it is quite impossible to persist in this view on an impartial reading in face of the continual assertion to the very end that action should be preferred to inaction, and that superiority lies with the true, the inner renunciation of desire by equality, and the giving up of works to the Supreme Purusha. So there are a number of citations there, which we can list if you've got a pencil and paper. Beginning in the third chapter, 3-4, 3-30, and then again, chapter 5, shlokas 2 and 3, chapter 6, verses 1 through 4, chapter 9, shloka 27, chapter 12, shloka 6, and of course, the 18th chapter, shloka 12. And that's simply the use of the term sannyasa. Sannyasa, meaning renunciation, is always of the inner object, as he says. And so Krishna brings into the discussion the difference between the outer renunciation of life, of works, etc., which could be interpreted by some, many in those days, as sannyasa, and what is tyaga, which is the inner renunciation. And that's what Sri Aurobindo refers to. As far as the giving up of works through equality to the Purushottama, that's chapter 15, shloka 18. Others again speak of the Gita as if the doctrine of devotion were its whole teaching, and put in the background its monistic elements and the high place it gives to quietistic emergence in the one self of all. And undoubtedly, its emphasis on devotion, its insistence on the aspect of the divine as Lord and Purusha, and its doctrine of the Purushottama, the Supreme Being, who is superior both to the mutable being and to the immutable, and who is what in his relation to the world we know as God, are the most striking and among the most vital elements of the Gita. Still, this Lord is the self in whom all knowledge culminates, and the master of sacrifice to whom all works lead, as well as the Lord of love, into whose being the heart of devotion enters. And the Gita preserves a perfectly equal balance, emphasizing now knowledge, now works, now devotion. But for the purposes of the immediate trend of the thought, not with any absolute separate preference of one over the others. He in whom all three meet and become one, he is the Supreme Being, the Purushottama. The word simply means supreme, ultimate person. And of course, this the teaching in the Gita is the most marvelous extension of the core insights of the Vedanta that we have in the Upanishads. And the early Upanishads really don't touch upon this as fully as the later one. The Shvetashvatara, the Katha, begin to come into the orbit of what the Gita will teach. But the Gita is a grand synthetical statement, bringing the purity of the absolute conscious existence beyond time and space, Brahman, into the wheelhouse of what a divine person does in manifesting the world and controlling its many elements and bringing all back to itself through the process of yoga. But the Gita doesn't lay it all out quite like that. It has a progressive teaching and reveals one lesson at a time, which is analogous to the way that the human learns. And so Arjuna gains one insight, digests it, is presented with another, grapples with it, pulls it into himself, and then moves to yet another. Back to the essay. But at the present day, since, in fact, the modern mind began to recognize and deal at all with the Gita, the tendency is to subordinate its elements of knowledge and devotion, to take advantage of its continual insistence on action, and to find in it a scripture of the Karma Yoga, a light leading us on the path of action, a gospel of works. Undoubtedly, the Gita is a gospel of works, but of works which culminate in knowledge, that is, in spiritual realization and quietude, and of works motived by devotion, that is, a conscious surrender of one's whole self, first into the hands and then into the being of the Supreme, and not at all of works as they are understood by the modern mind, not at all an action dictated by egoistic and altruistic, by personal, social, humanitarian motives, principles, ideals. Yet this is what present-day interpretations seek to make of the Gita. We are told continually by many authoritative voices that the Gita, opposing in this the ordinary ascetic and quietistic tendency of Indian thought and spirituality, proclaims with no uncertain sound the gospel of human action, the ideal of disinterested performance of social duties, nay, even it would seem, the quite modern ideal of social service. Read Tolstoy. To all this, I can only reply that very patently and even on the very surface of it, the Gita does nothing of the kind, and that this is a modern misreading, a reading of the modern mind into an ancient book, of the present-day European or Europeanized intellect into a thoroughly antique, a thoroughly Oriental and Indian teaching. That which the Gita teaches is not a human, but a divine action. Not the performance of social duties, but the abandonment of all other standards of duty or conduct for a selfless performance of the divine will working through our nature. Not social service, but the action of the best, the God-possessed, the master men done impersonally for the sake of the world and as a sacrifice to him who stands behind man and nature. For the sake of the world, loka sangraha, holding the world together. For that one, that being, the Purushottama, who is instanced in every being here and in the cosmos as a whole, and so is not absent, but intimate to our work and guiding our work. This is a different kind of action, how to awaken to that presence, how to commune with it, how to allow it to direct our self-offered energies. Huh, this is the secret of work. In other words, he says, the Gita is not a book of practical ethics, but of the spiritual life. The modern mind is just now the European mind, just such as it has become after having abandoned not only the philosophic idealism of the highest Greco-Roman culture from which it started, but the Christian devotionalism of the Middle Ages. These it has replaced by or transmuted into a practical idealism and social, patriotic, and philanthropic devotion. It has got rid of God, or kept him only for Sunday use, and erected in his place man as its deity and society as its visible idol. At its best, it is practical, ethical, social, pragmatic, altruistic, humanitarian. Now, all these things are good, are especially needed at the present day, are part of the divine will, or they would not have become so dominant in humanity. Nor is there any reason why the divine man, the man who lives in the Brahmic consciousness, in the God being, should not be all of these things in his action. He will be, if they are the best ideal of the age, the Yuga Dharma, and there is no yet higher ideal to be established, no great radical change to be effected, for he is, as the teacher points out to his disciple, the best who has to set the standard for others. And in fact, Arjuna is called upon to live according to the highest ideals of his age and the prevailing culture, but with knowledge, with understanding of that which lay behind, and not as ordinary men, with a following of the merely outward law and rule. So it isn't the external teaching, the code of ethics, the superficial dharma, but an inner law, and the best shrestas. Third chapter, Shloka 21. Arjuna is the best. It is interesting that Sri Aurobindo phrases this, couches this language where there is no great radical change to be effected. Because, of course, the integral yoga does aim at a radical change, a departure from merely making the human superlative and live in communion with the divine, but actually bring the elements of the divine being and consciousness into flesh here upon earth. A very different task. He continues, but the point here is that the modern mind has exiled from its practical motive power the two essential things, God, or the eternal, and spirituality, or the God state, which are the master conceptions of the Gita. It lives in humanity only, and the Gita would have us live in God, though for the world in God. In its life, heart, and intellect only. And the Gita would have us live in the spirit, in the mutable being who is all creatures. And the Gita would have us live also in the immutable and the supreme, in the changing march of time. And the Gita would have us live in the eternal. Or if these higher things are now beginning to be vaguely envisaged, it is only to make them subservient to man and society. But God and spirituality exist in their own right and not as adjuncts. And in practice, the lower in us must learn to exist for the higher, in order that the higher also may in us consciously exist for the lower, to draw it nearer to its own altitudes. So here you have a suggestion of this circularity, ascent, descent. We aspire, we commune, we bring back that which we commune with into our orbit. It descends with us willingly, encouragingly. Therefore, it is a mistake to interpret the Gita from the standpoint of the mentality of today and force it to teach us the disinterested performance of duty as the highest and all-sufficient law. A little consideration of the situation with which the Gita deals will show us that this could not be its teaching. For the whole point of the teaching, that from which it arises, that which compels the disciple to seek the teacher, is an inextricable clash of the various related conceptions of duty, ending in the collapse of the whole useful intellectual and moral edifice erected by the human mind. In human life, some sort of a clash arises fairly often, as for instance, between domestic duties and the call of the country or the cause, or between the claim of the country and the good of humanity, or some larger religious or moral principle. An inner situation may even arise, as with the Buddha, in which all duties have to be abandoned, trampled on, flung aside in order to follow the call of the divine within. I cannot think that the Gita would solve such an inner situation by sending Buddha back to his wife and father in the government of the Shakya state, or would direct a Ramakrishna to become a pundit in a vernacular school and disinterestedly teach little boys their lessons, or bind down a Vivekananda to support his family and for that to follow dispassionately the law or medicine or journalism. The Gita does not teach the disinterested performance of duties, but the following of the divine life, the abandonment of all dharmas, sarva dharman, to take refuge in the supreme alone, and the divine activity of a Buddha, a Ramakrishna, a Vivekananda is perfectly in consonance with this teaching. And he has just referred to the abandonment of all dharmas, chapter 18, shloka 66. Nay, although the Gita prefers action to inaction, it does not rule out the renunciation of works, but accepts it as one of the ways to the divine. And that can only be attained by renouncing works and life and all duties, and the call is strong within us, then into the bonfire they must go, and there is no help for it. The call of God is imperative and cannot be weighed against any other considerations. One has to know oneself. As the Gita begins, Arjuna does not know himself. But here, there is this farther difficulty, that the action which Arjuna must do is one from which his moral sense recoils. It is his duty to fight, you say, but that duty has now become to his mind a terrible sin. How does it help him or solve his difficulty to tell him that he must do his duty disinterestedly, dispassionately? He will want to know which is his duty or how it can be his duty to destroy in a sanguinary massacre his kin, his race, and his country. He is told that he has a right on his side. He is told that he has right on his side, but that does not and cannot satisfy him, because his very point is that the justice of his legal claim does not justify him in supporting it by a pitiless massacre destructive to the future of his nation. Is he then to act dispassionately in the sense of not caring whether it is a sin or what its consequences may be, so long as he does his duty as a soldier? That may be the teaching of a state, of politicians, of lawyers, of ethical casuists. It can never be the teaching of a great religious and philosophical scripture which sets out to solve the problem of life and action, and from the very roots. A casuist is one who sophistically argues and studies matters by the case. It can lead, obviously, to situational ethics. And if that is what the Gita has to say on a most poignant moral and spiritual problem, we must put it out of the list of the world's scriptures and thrust it, if anywhere, then into our library of political science and ethical casuistry. Poignant, by the way, means stinging, sharply painful. Undoubtedly, the Gita does, like the Upanishads, teach the equality which rises above sin and virtue, beyond good and evil, but only as a part of the Brahmic consciousness and for the man who is on the path and advanced enough to fulfill the supreme rule. It does not preach indifference to good and evil for the ordinary life of man, where such a doctrine would have the most pernicious consequences. This idea of equality, let's note chapter 2, shloka 48, chapter 10, shloka 5, chapter 14, shloka 26. So 2, 48, 10, 5, 14, 26. It does not preach indifference to good and evil for the ordinary life of man, where such a doctrine would have the most pernicious consequences. On the contrary, it affirms that the doers of evil shall not attain to God. Chapter 7, shloka 15. Therefore, if Arjuna simply seeks to fulfill in the best way the ordinary law of man's life, disinterested performance of what he feels to be a sin, a thing of hell, will not help him, even though that sin be his duty as a soldier. He must refrain from what his conscience abhors, although 1,000 duties were shattered to pieces. Well, I know we hang on the horns of a dilemma there, but that's where we're going to put our bookmark this time. And we'll finish the chapter next we meet. And I do realize that everyone is in the midst of their personal Kurukshetra, really every moment that we're conscious. And that Sri Aurobindo, as he penned this, was in the midst of World War I, having emerged a few years earlier from a stage in which he learnt the teaching of the Gita by solitary confinement in the Alipur jail, where he had two companions, the Gita to uplift him and energize him with its teaching, and the Upanishads to help him refine his meditation practice. And when he came back, it was with a larger heart, in a greater vision, and he again took up the quest and the challenge for political change, because he still was commanded to that at that moment. He was drawn away by Krishna, compellingly, increasingly, away from political fields of service towards a transformative ideal that was greater. And of course, to approach that greater truth and draw it towards us drew many fractious elements from chthonic forces beneath to meet, oppose, distract, and derail. And here we are, still dealing with that. And the only solution is to live divinely and to realize who and what we are and to weld ourselves together in a spiritual community and support light as it confronts darkness always. Darkness must be subdued. They say 3203 BC, Duryodhana has to be opposed. And we will, again and again, as we do every year, Durga Puja, put down darkness with the conquest of light. But it is not the supernal light that will change things. It is a greater light. But we, spiritual warriors, have to ascend and climb beyond merely the realization of the self, of the presence of Brahman, beyond even the discovery of our own innate souls, and reach that solar splendor and live from that. That alone can heal the divisions that we face continually upon the earth and bring spirit and matter into harmony. We're here, and we can't abandon the field, but let's remember what our primary objectives are. They are all inner first. Arjuna will be shown his inner being, and then he can return to his work in the world, appointed to destroy dark forces and to sustain the Sanatana Dharma. Here we are. Let us continue our work. Well, I've wandered. I wanted to read to you a section from Savitri. This is in Book 1, Canto 3, The Yoga of the King, The Yoga of the Soul's Release. So here, Book 1, Canto 3, we start on page 23. At last the traveler in the paths of time arrives on the frontiers of eternity. In the transient symbol of humanity draped, he feels his substance of undying self and loses his kinship to mortality. A beam of the eternal smites his heart. His thought stretches into infinitude. All in him turns to spirit vastnesses. His soul breaks out to join the oversoul. His life is oceaned by that superlife. He has drunk from the breasts of the mother of the worlds. A topless supernature fills his frame. She adopts his spirit's everlasting ground as the security of her changing world, and shapes the figure of her unborn mites. Immortally, she conceives herself in him, in the creature, the unveiled creatrix works. Her face is seen through his face, her eyes through his eyes. Her being is his through a vast identity. Then is revealed in man the overt divine. A static oneness and dynamic power descend in him, the integral Godhead seals. his soul and body take that splendid stamp. A long, dim preparation is man's life, a circle of toil and hope and war and peace, tracked out by life on matter's obscure ground. In his climb to a peak no feet have ever trod, he seeks through a penumbra shot with flame, a veiled reality half known, ever missed, a search for something or someone never found, cult of an ideal never made real here, an endless spiral of ascent and fall, until at last is reached the giant point through which his glory shines for whom we were made, and we break into the infinity of God. I know, there's more in the passage. Namaste, Jai Ma.